Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show with your morning show hosts, Julie Calamine and my co-host, Phil Hoff. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, Julie. How are you?
I'm great. How have you been?
Oh, wonderful. Fall weekend, really cloudy and rainy one day, really nice the other. So we went out hiking in the cloudy, rainy day.
I heard that. And I heard you went high and you had a long hike this weekend.
We hiked the Scotchman Peak. We did a little crosscut saw. We saw no goats. We saw a lot of fog, but we had a good time. Introduced two new people to the mountain.
That's kind of a big deal. And Scotchman, this time of the year, it's the perfect time to hike that hike. You're not hot. The days are a little shorter, but what a wonderful, wonderful time to get up there and do it.
Looks like some fish jumping out on the lake.
Oh, boy. There are a few. So I was not out fishing, but I was out hiking about, kind of looking around for mushrooms, doing all that fall hiking fun sort of thing we do when the weather's not hot. We can get out and about. It's been great, great weather.
Love October.
Yes. And now we've got a bit of rain and I am going to talk about the weather briefly, and then we're going to introduce our morning show guest. So today we can expect some, we've probably seen it if you've woken up, but we've got breezy, rainy sort of day today, high of 54 with rain most likely. Tonight we're looking at partly cloudy weather with a low down to 34. Each morning it's getting closer and closer to frosting every morning. Of course it's frosted a lot of places, but pretty frosty most mornings these days. Then tomorrow, Wednesday, plan on a mostly sunny day with a high of 54. And Wednesday night it'll again be partly cloudy with a cool, close to freezing weather, low of 31. And the rest of the week is going on in that sort of pattern. Highs in the middle upper 50s, lows in the 30-ish range. So we're in fall weather. We've got a little rain, a little sun, beautiful fall Sandpoint weather. Yes. So.
And we have a great show this morning. One of the most knowledgeable people on all topics forestry related is here in the studio with us. Chris Schnepf, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Chris is from the University of Idaho's Area Extension Office in Coeur d'Alene, an educator, professor of forestry, oversees the Master Steward Forest Program, and so much more, and we'll start to unpack some of that.
That's right, and I believe it's the first time we've ever been lucky enough to have you on our morning show program, Chris, so we're so happy to have you here.
I'm glad to be here. It's fun.
That's good. Well, Chris, why don't you tell us, for those of us who don't know Chris, and that there must be a few in Sandpoint, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, how you came to be where you are today?
Well, I grew up on a farm in northwest Iowa, and along the Floyd River, which the only person that died in the Lewis and Clark expedition, and had a, you know, hunted, fish, trapped, just lived down on the river. And so I knew I wanted to go into something related to ecology, and did my undergraduate at Iowa State, and forestry was my choice because it's probably one of the better applied ecology degrees that you can get. So I did my graduate in forestry and double major in environmental studies to kind of broaden out the coursework I was taking.
And I've got to back up. When you say applied, what do you mean by that?
I mean actively doing something with the landscape. In one sense, we're actively doing things with the landscape, whether we ever set foot on them, in terms of introduced insects and diseases, fire suppression, you know, what's going on with climate and everything.
But not sitting in the office or in the lab looking at slides all the time, something like that.
No, although I do a fair amount of that too.
I'll bet.
So I really like being outdoors. And when I was at Iowa State, we had our forestry camp in Montana. And as a lifelong fly fisherman, and the experience of June and July with the humidity never getting over 30%, I knew what part of the world I wanted to end up in.
There you go.
So I worked seasonally for the Forest Service for about 4 years during and after my undergraduate degree. Then went to work for the Rocky Mountain Research Station in Moscow, doing plot work all over the Idaho Panhandle for about 2 years. And then ended up going to grad school at WSU, where I did degrees in forestry and adult education.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and a great combination for an extension professor.
It really is. It's really served me well over the years.
So I think the work you do and the office you're in, to me, is the story of that alone is pretty fascinating. When most people think of universities, they think of kids between the ages of 18 and 22 sitting in a classroom, and maybe they go out on a field experience. But the Extension Office is literally a way to extend that learning environment outwards. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, Extension kind of got started with the creation of land-grant universities. And you see those big blocks of blue, or in some states other colors, blocks of land that are managed by the state. That was land set aside during the Lincoln administration to fund public universities, what are called land grants, because the land grant is what initially funded them. Every state in the United States has at least one land grant. In Northwest, it's Oregon State, University of Idaho, and WSU, for example. And, of course, Iowa State got through that. The primary purpose of those land-grant universities was to be the education or provide education for the common people. So degrees are a part of that. There's also been a strong tradition at land grants of making a difference in the world in terms of the type of research that's done. There's plenty of basic research done at land grants too, especially now. But the idea is making a difference in the world. And then in the early 1915, the Smith-Lever Act was passed. And there was various experiments going on with adult education at the time all over the United States, the Chautauqua movement. Some of the agrarian clubs and everything, you know, county fairs really were originally a technology transfer thing for agriculture. So in 1915, there were some positive experiments going on in several states, and they ended up starting the Cooperative Extension Service, which is a three-way relationship between the federal government, the states through the land-grant universities, and local government, the counties. So most counties in the United States have an extension office. That's generally the office and the staff are paid for by the local county. And we have one here in Bonner County as well as the other panhandle counties. And then a university will put anywhere from one to four faculty in an office as befits the area that they're working in. And the big role of extension people is to bring university research to bear on local issues. So we have I work in forestry. We have other people work in ag, family consumer sciences. Jim Eakins has a position similar to mine, working in water quality. A big part of it is research out to the communities, but that's also supposed to work the other direction as well. So when we hear of needs in local communities that could be addressed by more research, you know, we direct that to campus and stuff. And an example of that, we recently, 2 years ago, the policy analysis group at the University of Idaho did a big survey of Idaho forest owners. And that's available on U of I policy analysis group website, and people can see what just how many family forest owners we have in the state and what sorts of things they're interested in.
And they bring that back to you all, and then hopefully some of that gets researched and answers come back to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the role of the counties and the role of the university is pretty obvious from the description you just had. Tell us how the state and federal governments come into play.
Well, the federal government, you know, kicks in a certain percentage of funding. I think in Idaho, it varies by state, but in Idaho, probably, last I checked, 20% of the total funding for cooperative extension comes from USDA. Mm-hmm. And then the state covers the remainder for the salaries and the extension faculty and staff we have on campus. And then the county's role primarily is to provide an office, provide administrative support. And, you know, extension is often talked about as a three-legged stool. Increasingly, it's a four-legged stool in that grants have become mm-hmm. a large part of our programming. And so I've got for stewardship grants through the Department of Lands that we do support the forestry workshops and stuff we do in the Panhandle, and support the, at least partially, the Idaho Master Forest Stewards Program. We have grants for publications and a variety of other things too.
Really helpful. I've read some of them. Chris, you mentioned that the funds are distributed to the various folks that are part of the extension group. We know it's agriculture and horticulture and forestry, and as you mentioned,
and 4-H too.
4-H, yes. Mm-hmm. And so, is it fairly evenly distributed, or does one group? I'm just wondering if it's fairly evenly distributed.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's evenly distributed, but I don't know that that's something to aspire to necessarily, because, you know, different communities in Idaho have different needs.
Sure.
You know, we don't have any SPUD specialists in North Idaho.
No.
And I don't expect to have any extension foresters down in
well, exactly.
You know,
down in Palouse. Yeah, you're not, we're not worried about forests quite so much.
Yeah.
The programs really do seem to respond to the community, be community driven. So from a personal standpoint, I know I've done everything from going in with a weed in my yard I couldn't identify to get some advice on what it is and how to manage it, to attending some of the workshops you've mentioned. And it's such a great opportunity for a wide array of knowledge and information that benefits the community.
It is. It's, you know, I always describe extension as creative, meaningful work.
Yes.
And you know, it's very much in the DNA of extension and, you know, really adult education. You know, our programs are always stronger to the extent they're locally driven. So our Master Forest Stewards, for me, function as, in addition to a peer-to-peer learning community among themselves and providing more resources to do outreach to other forest owners, they really drive our programs. You know, they're structured as a participatory action research network, which is a strain of qualitative research that really makes people that you're doing research with partners rather than just the objects of research. And, you know, we just get great feedback from them. And we've come up with some programs in recent years that were really generated by the volunteers. So we did a program in Sandpoint and Coeur d'Alene this year called 10 Acres in a Dream.
I remember seeing that when advertised. It sounded so interesting.
Yeah. And it was, you know, people who are new to the area and don't know the basics of rural living, to say nothing of dealing with invasive species or forestry or you know, what increasingly what's called a modern homesteading movement of people moving back to land and wanting to grow more of their own food and stuff. So
that's right. Well, you know, Chris, when we were on the phone talking about you joining us this morning, you were very clear with me that I described the Master Steward Forest Program not as foresters, but as a forest program. So why don't you define this program for us? Tell us what it's about and who gets involved in it.
Sure. Well, you know, we've been doing a whole variety of stewardship programs. We put out a calendar every year that lists everything we have going on for over 25 years now in North Idaho. And we have a variety of forest owners and really active learners who have taken most of the programs we've offered and were ready for something new. And you combine that with our limited capacity in extension forestry in Idaho. I'm one of two full-time extension foresters in the state of Idaho. And so we're always looking for ways to increase capacity to respond to more forest owners. And so we've done that with – Extension has done that quite a bit with other what we call master volunteer programs. So Extension offices obviously get a lot of calls on home horticulture issues. And so the Master Gardener program was developed to respond to the various, you know, fire calls Extension offices get on insects and diseases that are damaging home gardens and landscapes. So we basically took that model – and then met with a group of the forest owners that most wanted to see us start something like that for forestry. And we had 2 one-day retreats where they essentially designed the program. I mean, I obviously had a voice in it, but I usually try to defer to the forest owners wherever possible. And what we came up with was a program that's 70 hours of training. And in return, people are expected to do 70 hours of volunteer service. And that volunteer service, you know, the Master Gardeners, they're dealing with home horticulture calls and extension office and then a few other things in addition to that. Our folks are have a lot more flexibility in how they do their volunteer service. So Renee Dow, who is here from Bonner County but spends most of the year in Switzerland, she does most of her volunteer hours as in writing. She's a published author. And other volunteers will work with the Idaho State Forestry Contest. A lot of our forest owners do peer-to-peer contacts with neighboring forest owners. In some cases, we'll have Master Forest Stewards actually teaching classes. So Kurt Cutter from Post Falls and has gathered some volunteers with him and has done a map and compass class for forest owners. Sometimes they'll help us with programs. So we do a forest measurements class where we break up into groups, and the Mass Forest Stewards lead other forest owners as they measure things like stand density and some of those kind of things. And we call it, we emphasize it's Master Forest Stewards, not Master Foresters, because the term forester in the forestry community has a very specific meaning mm-hmm. that the forester is someone who has at least a four-year degree in forestry from an institution that's accredited by the Society of American Foresters. That's not to take anything away from people who have 30 years of experience in the woods and everything, or any other, you know, dimension of forestry. So we call them Master Forest Stewards. Now, we do have a couple of Master Forest Stewards that have forestry degrees. You know, what sometimes you get folks that particularly who work for a federal agency and end up spending a lot of their career in kind of middle management jobs, not getting out in the woods. They retire and they want to take part in our program because it's about, you know, what they first fell in love with about forestry, which is being out in the woods and working with people who want to take care of their forests.
So Master Gardeners has been around in a lot of places for a number of years. It's mm-hmm. replicated. This sounds like it's a unique program to our area, or it's starting here. Is it exported? Has it been exported elsewhere?
I don't know that it's necessarily been exported as such. There's probably about a dozen programs like it across the country. They go by different names and they have different structures and everything. For example, Oregon was probably the first one to really do this with forestry, and they call their program Master Woodland Managers. Other states, it's combined with wildlife more fully. So in the Northeast, for example, they had the coverts program, which was kind of equal parts forestry and rough grouse management. Other states call it a VIP program. You know, some of the programs are as little as 30 hours. We're probably at the high end in terms of the amount of training required. But again, that was I was initially thinking it was going to be 40, 50 hours, and the volunteers wanted to make it 70 hours.
There's a lot to know. Yeah. And yeah. Additionally, we here in Idaho have the Master Naturalist program, and that's a more, I think, my understanding of it anyway is that it's a little more general, that program.
Yeah, and probably a little more focused on wildlife. You know, mm-hmm. I helped write the curricula for that program for the forestry piece of it. And it's run through Idaho Fish and Game, which that's kind of their role. And you know, what I find is there's a surprisingly large number of people who are volunteers in multiples of these programs. You know, so we have Master Forest Stewards who are also Master Gardeners, and a couple who have been also Master Naturalists. And in terms of counting their hours and everything for the program, I let people double dip if they want to. If they want to count Master Gardener hours as Master Forest Stewards, I'm fine with that.
Works for you.
Well, because it's the interest of all the programs to have volunteers mm-hmm. that have that much more training and education, because there's cross-pollination in terms of the research base on all these programs.
So it's a great program, and you mentioned some component parts of it, but mm-hmm. but folks can take some of those courses on their own.
Absolutely. Yeah, so a lot, you know, and this is kind of unique with our program. You know, like Master Gardeners and similar Master Forestry programs, they have their own kind of self-contained course that you go through. Our folks opted for something different, especially, you know, considering how few FTEs we have in forestry in this state. So about half the training is programs that people can take at any time, like our forestry short course, insect and disease field day, the thinning and pruning field day. Those are all part of the training. Mm-hmm. And you get credit for having attended those, even if it was 10 to 12 mm-hmm. years ago or something that you took it. And then, in addition to that, there are 4 one-day sessions that are just for Master Forest Stewards, that are typically held at in some kind of field campus, you know, where we have a classroom and then we can step outdoors and do field activities. So, Preserve Experimental Forest mm-hmm. is often one of our sites for that.
Sure. You've mentioned that the courses, it sounds as though they don't need to be taken in any particular sequential order. Are there online courses, or are any of those online?
None of them are online. Mm-hmm. You know, there are 7 elective credits, which I'd certainly accept online stuff for part of that. But, you know, part of learning forestry is getting out in the woods.
I agree. Yeah. I think it's true.
And there is a very strong emphasis in the program on peer-to-peer learning, and Mass Forest Stewards is a peer learning community. And, you know, the spree core you develop in a classroom is quite different than what you can maybe develop in an online offering, my experience.
So tell us a little bit about how the practice of education and the application of these knowledges is similar or different in our area. We live in an area that's an abundant variety of species, more so than in many places in the West. So tell us about that experience here.
Well, you know, forestry is fundamentally applied ecology. And, you know, sometimes gets lost on people a little bit when they're seeing, you know, more aggressive silvicultural practices. But, you know, even with some of the more aggressive silvicultural practices, like, you know, a clear cut for a standard generation cut, we're generally managing native species.
And I've got to back up for listeners who maybe don't know every term. Define silviculture for us.
Yeah, thank you. Silviculture is the technical term for the culture of forest. So silva is from the Latin root for forest. So silviculture is simply the culture of forest. And it includes a range of things that you would do, reflecting the wide range of objectives we have for forest management. So, you know, locking the gate in front of a wilderness area could be considered, you know, a silvicultural practice. But you know, obviously harvesting and thinning, but also tree planting, pre-commercial thinning, things you'd be doing for wildlife. Basically, how do you tend a forest over its entire life? And again, reflecting multiple objectives. And that's the other place where our extension programs start from, is what are the objectives of the landowner? Our goal is to help them meet their goals. And obviously, there's some public interest in those forests being well managed as well. Mm-hmm. So to get back to your question, Phil, the first thing is to ground people in our ecology. So we talk a lot about the different tree species we have, the different forest types we have, how those forests change over time. You know, some people look at a fire and see a forest gone forever. A forester looks at that site and looks at an earlier successional stage of a forest, and then we go into, you know, what are the trees? How do these forests change over time? What are the characteristics of these trees, particularly regarding shade tolerance? You know, all of our species, sometimes people talk about sun loving or shade loving. Really, our species vary in degrees of shade tolerance. Mm-hmm. And that has to be considered if you're trying to regenerate those species. And then we spend a lot of time talking about insects and disease, because that's often the first contact we have with people, is when they see trees having problems. And most of our responses to those things are preventative in nature. In that sense, forestry has been practicing integrated pest management in terms of building resilient systems before IPM was even coined, because there simply hasn't been the option of using, you know, chemicals or things like that to deal with forest pests.
I think what's fascinating to me is the rich diversity here lends itself to so many more choices and options. That,
absolutely.
A forest fire burns through much of the West, what's going to return are lodgepole pine. A forest fire here burns, or an area is being actively managed, and you look at those site-specific requirements, and there's such an abundant variety of species that might be planted.
Yeah, it's North Idaho is a delightful place to be a forester. We have 10, you know, native commercially harvestable tree species, and then, you know, I've done a fair amount of work on habitat types, which is a way of classifying land based on the overstory and understory vegetation and plant communities, and boy, just a really wide range of types here. So it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
And Chris, you're working, of course, in our program, in the Master Steward Forest Program. That's mainly working with people on smaller tracts of land, of course. They're, I would guess, in most cases, not huge tracts of land. How does that compare to, you know, doing something like, as example, with the Forestry Service? It must be quite different.
Well, it is. Although, you know, in aggregate, what we used to call non-industrial private forests, or what we now call family forests, They make up 40% of the forest land in these four Idaho panhandle counties that I work in.
It's a lot more than I expected.
Yeah, a lot of folks look out, see the woods, they think it's all Forest Service, but most of the trees and forests that you see on a day-to-day basis are these family forest owners. Mm-hmm. And some of them are as little as, 5 acres or so. We have others that have, up to 2,000 acres or more. So it's, I think what's different relative to managing public lands is these people, especially in Idaho, have a tremendous amount of freedom to manage their lands as they see appropriate. And we find just a wide range of things people want to manage. Typically people don't want to manage for one thing. Even the person that's really interested in income, ask them about their forest, and the first they're going to tell you about is wildlife and all the other things that they enjoy seeing out there.
And there's a need for the education that we're talking about here, because so much of our landscape is covered with forest, and a lot of it is private land. And it's right. Not just large tracts of industrial private land, but the smaller family tracts that benefit from that management.
Right. And those lands are hugely important from the standpoint of they tend to be some of the more used pieces of lands for recreation and everything. The kid with on a bicycle, a Zebco reel, is probably going to a stream related to a family forest rather than up into the national forest area. But they also are important for low elevation wildlife and plant species. Mm-hmm. They tend to be disproportionately concentrated near streams and water bodies, so which tend to be ecological checkpoints. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of what we do with our extension forestry programs is giving people an ecological literacy for how our growers, mm-hmm. and it's really important that people understand, how our forests are quite different than they would have been prior mm-hmm. to European settlement. Fire exclusion, partial harvest practices, and the introduction of non-native insects and disease, white pine blister rust being one of the bigger ones, mm-hmm. Have resulted in a forest that's quite different in terms of species composition. They're all native trees here and everything, but it's very different in terms of how it functions ecologically compared to how it was historically.
And you've just brought up so much, and there's so much more to talk about. We want to get into the details of some of the programs.
Okay.
For folks who are just tuning in, this is 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. And this morning's guest on the morning show is Chris Schneff, University of Idaho Area Extension Educator. We're going to take a short music break and then come back and talk about some of the specific programs that touch on the topics Chris just mentioned. And towards the end of the show, we're going to talk about the auction that helps to support community-supported public radio for North Idaho.
Yes, we are. And so we'll take a short music break, and we're going to be hearing the Beatles Yesterday. And we've just been talking about yesterday's woods, so it's appropriate. And also, it's the anniversary of yesterday, isn't it, Phil?
It is. I think it was about 50 years ago that it came out as the number one song on this date.
And covered by so many folks, but we're going to hear the Beatles with Yesterday.
Yesterday.
That's correct.
But we're here today, and today we're here with Chris Schneff from the University of Idaho's Extension Office. We're talking forestry, master forests, big picture of education. We're going to talk about some of the specific programs. A couple were mentioned in passing, but I think folks would be interested in finding out more about them, sure. What's entailed, how much of a commitment to time, and when they're available. So let's start with which one's coming up first.
Well, the first one coming up is our forestry short course, which we generally do at least twice a year. It's 6 3-hour sessions designed to coach people on the development of or revision of a forest management plan for the property. Mm-hmm. And a management plan is often required to get the lower property tax rate for forest land use by many Idaho counties. One of the most important fiscal incentives to good forest management in the state of Idaho, certainly the most used. Mm-hmm. It includes some grounding in forest ecology, the types of insects and diseases that we have in North Idaho, and how to identify them, how to manage for them. Some stuff on silvicultural systems, so stand regeneration cuts, thinning operations, managing fertility, wildlife management, and then also things on forest taxes, fiscal incentive programs. Right now, there's only one called the EQIP program, where landowners can get cost share money for the different forest practices that they would put on their property.
Well, we do get a tax exemption. We can get a forestry tax exemption on our
acreage. Not properly an exemption. It's more a reduced property tax rate for a different land use, similar to what the farmers get.
Sure, got
it. And in order to qualify it, this is one of the ways to qualify for it.
Yeah, you can. Some counties will require a forester to sign off on the plan, but you know, some of the folks that have gone through our course and written their own plan, you know, they're a lot more invested in it. And I've had a number of times where a landowner tell me they met with a consultant and said, I'm not sure how much more there is for me to do here. That having been said, even if they still go out and hire a consulting forester to work with them, it'll just be a much richer conversation and more. And the plan's going to be more in sync with what landowners' goals are because they know more.
And Chris, you mentioned some of the areas that people learn about their personal private forest, but what about fire prevention? Is that something you cover, or do you bring in forest folks, Forest Service folks?
No, we cover it. And a lot of our programs, you know, I do a lot of teaching, obviously, but I often try to bring in people from multiple agencies and organizations to kind of broaden and enrich, and especially for a very specialized area expertise. You know, in a sense, we cover fire quite a bit just from the standpoint of thinning and what are the most fire-adapted sort of forest structures that you can have in your forest. We also do programming on protecting homes from wildfire. That's a challenging program to get people out for, unfortunately. So, you know, if community group has at least 10 people firmly committed, you know, we'll schedule a program with them, but yes, we hit that, and we have a number of publications on those, the fire topics as well.
So a lot of broad benefits to the short course in forestry, from personal protection to enhancement of the land, the potential tax incentives. Do folks who are taking it need to have some background? Can they come in as I've just moved to the area and I need to know more about these things?
That description fits a lot of the people that take the program.
Yeah.
It's really our flagship, you know, primer on forestry. And people, it includes, recognizing different people's learning styles. It includes a three-ring notebook of program notes and everything, and a little wooden thumbnail drive with 150 plus extension publications on there in PDF form.
Seems to me there'd be very few people who wouldn't benefit from that if they had any land at all here in the area.
Yeah, we've gotten consistently good reviews for it, and people really enjoy it.
And it's not technically part of that course, but it seems like it dovetails in very nicely. In December, you usually have the current topics in forest health.
Yeah, we do a program every December called Current Topics in Forest Health, and that's just to review, you know, new science, new research, or topics that are currently really active. So last year we hit fir and graver beetle, or sometimes referred to by its scientific name, scolitis, which has really been hitting grand fir in our region pretty heavy this year. But, you know, we will have programs on presentation of the new weeds and stuff to our area, new technologies to deal with weeds, different ways of dealing with mammal threats. You know, black bears have been a huge issue in Bonner County, and we've had program presentations on that as well.
So are you giving us a preview of this December's lineup, or have you decided what's on it yet?
To some extent, yeah. We've pretty much lined up all the speakers. I had hoped to have a company on the west side that is applying seeds, looking to plant trees, and applying herbicides with swarms of drones. And I saw some video and one of their drones at a national conference last week in Portland, and it's for real. I'm not that confident they're going to be able to plant trees with drones. You know, that's been experimented with many years over the years in forestry.
So I'm trying to picture that. Is that a broadcast thing, like a crop duster, or
it's a mini helicopter.
Okay.
And you know, it's safer than flying a helicopter in a forest environment. They're lower to the ground, so you don't get as much drift. And they're using them a lot in aerial seeding for areas that have had wildfires and stuff, because they can get the seed on, you know, pretty promptly.
And, you know, without going too far down the hole of the drones, that's an emerging technology that foresters are using even for fundamental things like STEM exams, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's you can mount any number of different infrared or LIDAR sensors to them. It just gets less expensive and has more capabilities every year. So it's, you know, it's, I know one landowner is using them for stocking surveys. Cause if you got a really steep slope, climbing through all there and measuring plots is, having done it, it's yeah. not always an easy thing. And if you can do that with a drone, you know, yeah. so much the better.
And maybe some job opportunities for forestry folks who would rather work with a drone than be out on the hillside.
It is one indication of how the whole industry is changing from the perception of these are blue-collar jobs, people in the woods with an axe and a crosscut saw, to a lot of times it's someone who's younger and trained on video game consoles and different kinds of technology.
Yeah, there's still a place for a cat and a chainsaw, yeah. you know, but there's the level of the biggest thing in harvest technologies now is something called tethered logging, where a cut the link machine is basically goes down a slope on a heavy cable. And of course there's so many more sorts on timber harvest and stuff now, and a lot of it's computerized.
But. I know you want to talk about at least one other program. We may have time for more, but you mentioned on the break to us a December program that sounded quite interesting.
So on December 1st, Jennifer Jensen, who's the extension person for works in horticulture here in Sandpoint, we're going to do a couple of back-to-back programs at the Sandpoint Center for Organic Agriculture. Just north of the Schweitzer Road, which is a new property that was donated to the University of Idaho to do research and extension programming at. And the morning is going to be a tree identification workshop of North Idaho conifers that I've been doing in recent years. And then the afternoon is a wreath-making class focused on integrating Idaho native trees into Christmas wreaths. And Jennifer's going to be leading that part of it.
And wreath making is an important industry. It was in Minnesota where I grew up, and it is here too.
Yeah, I've done a fair amount of work over the years in what are sometimes called special forest products or non-timber forest products. But people have no idea how much money there is associated with some of those things. There's this is getting to be old research, but about 15 years ago when they did some economic analysis, they estimated $50 million returned to harvesters of floral greens in the Pacific Northwest.
Wow.
$11 million returned to harvesters of edible wild mushrooms. I'm betting it's a similar figure for huckleberries. And I'm betting both those figures are an underestimate because of the cash economy nature of it.
I would think so. That's right.
And that brings up a number of topics probably for future shows.
Sure.
But we think about forestry, we think about trees, but the forests really are so much more than just the trees.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are. We've talked about a couple of classes, the short course and the upcoming courses at the end of the year. Are there any other courses that people might want to watch out for? Or watch for, not watch
sure.
out for.
Sure. Well, you know, our thinning and pruning field day that we do every year, I'm not sure location of it this year, but somewhere in a panhandle every year, you know, that's pretty fundamental because you can, so many of our forests are overdense and composed of the less than ideal species, Doug fir and grand fir being a couple of the problematic species in terms of they're good, they're all God's creatures, they're good trees, but many of our sites have many more of them than they ever had historically, and that gives us much bigger issues of root disease than we would have had normally historically. Speaking of diseases, one of the ones that we're probably going to do in the Priest Lake area this summer is pruning to restore white pine. You can improve the survival of just naturally regenerated western white pine in our area by 50% just by pruning the trees up 8 to 10 feet. And there's, you know, you have to know how to identify blist rust and know which trees are even good to spend time on. But that's many of our programs are a little bit of time indoors covering some of the conceptual things. And then we go out in the woods. And so people... on both the thinning and pruning field day and the white pine restoration workshop, people have an opportunity to go out and try different hand tools and saws. And we have these Japanese pruning saws that can go up 20 feet.
I think we know about those ones. They're the talk of the town.
And who doesn't love adult education where you get out in the woods and play with toys?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. You know,
sharp ones.
Hands-on learning is a big theme in extension programming.
Well, as we come to the end of our morning program, I'd just like to ask you if there's anything else important you'd like to talk about in relationship to your work and what we've been focusing on this morning, Chris.
Well, for if you're really into forestry and or forests and you enjoy engaging with other people who share those values, I'd encourage people to take a look at the Idaho Mass Forest Stewards Program. We take applications for that continually. If we have at least 10 people signed up by August, we go ahead and schedule the core sessions for that next year. So we have enough. So we're going to be holding the core sessions this year, and we still have a few slots open on that.
And if someone just wants to know more about it, they can contact you and you can.
Absolutely. And we have a lot of information online about all these various programs.
All right.
As well.
And where would they look online? What should they look
up? If you Google UIdaho Extension Forestry, that will get you to our Extension Forestry webpage pretty quickly, and you can click away from there.
And there's plenty of master forest stewards around to mentor them, to talk to them about whether or not it's right for them.
Yeah, absolutely. If people contact me, my email address is cschnepf. Well, go to the website. You'll find
Google it.
I won't go through the spelling my last name ritual.
Chris, but wonderful to have you on the show this morning. If there's anything ever emerging that you want to come on late-breaking issues in current forest health or otherwise, let us know.
I'll remember that.
We appreciate it. So much to learn about our local forests, and we've got a person who can help us with that, and a larger resource in the Master Steward Forest Program. So we thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
If you tuned in late, missed any of the interview, or just want to re-listen to some of the suggestions, as always, you can go to krfy.org. Download the podcast available later today.
That's correct.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about other ways you can support community radio for North Idaho, our online auction, and we're going to bring in station manager Susie Perez to talk about that.
A big morning for us. Well, in the meantime, we're going to take a short music break and hear Tom Paxton's The Name of Trees. Could it be more perfect, Phil?
Not much.
And that was Tom Paxton with The Names of Trees. And Phil, we didn't hear too many names of trees, but we did just have a wonderful interview by Chris Schnepf from the University of Idaho Extension.
Yeah, we heard names of tree species, but...
True. No personal names.
No
not
personal
like Frank
names.
And George.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we'll save those for later. But yeah, if you're excited about trees and you want to hear more topics on the morning show, it's important that our community steps up and supports community radio in a very, very easy, fun and beneficial way to do that is our fall online auction. With us in the studio now is Susie Perez, our station manager, to tell us more about it.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about the trees and leaves. And as the trees are turning, as the leaves are turning and the fall rains approach, every year at this time, KRFY has their fall online auction. And it's up and running right now. And it is our biggest fundraiser. And some people don't understand or might not know that KRFY is a nonprofit. We are needing our community to step up, and the business community and individuals have generously donated amazing array of items for our auction this year. But what we need now is for folks to go online and bid on these amazing items.
That's right. We've gotten help from our business leaders and individuals, and now we need help from you all that are listening. So you need to go to the web, to the site.
So tell us about some of the items. I think there's Seahawks tickets, if I remember.
There are Seattle preseason 2019 tickets, a pair. So you can be right on the 30-yard line, and you can see a preseason game in August next year. Plus, you get to stay at a beautiful 5-star hotel in Seattle. I think it's called the W.
Wow.
And, nice. You know, so there's a big fancy weekend for you. And those tickets are impossible to get. Even preseason are, because this is a sold-out team, and they did win last weekend, by the way.
Very good.
And we have 15 restaurants, and I'm just going to name a few. We have iCarts. These are gift certificates to these different food establishments. We have Babs Pizzeria, Tango Cafe, Mandala Pizza, Cedar Street Bistro, 41 South, Lou's out there. We have The Fat Pig. We have Jalapenos. Various things from gift certificates for a certain amount to appetizers or entrees, floating restaurant, Ivano's famous lasagna, McDuff's sushi dinner. That's a catered specialty. Ooh. And Trinity at City Beach.
Wow.
Wow.
That's just the beginning.
Quite a range, though, from smaller certificates to pretty big deals. A catered sushi dinner would be a
and then there's
neat thing.
Gourmet food items. Yes, Phil.
Stuff before or after the dinner, too, right?
Right.
Panada
right.
tickets?
Panada tickets, a pair of tickets to see a movie. We have POAC season, two different shows for POAC with four tickets each. Coming up, and let's see, we have the festival at Sandpoint season tickets.
Yeah. That's a big one. And remind us again, where do people go to begin bidding?
So if you want to know how to support KRFY, this is how you do it. It's fun and it's easy to do. You go to krfy.org and find the auction button on the right, or go directly to the auction site at biddingforgood.com/KRFY. You can check out the auction items, sign up to bid, which is really simple, and then help support this community radio station. It's happening now. It runs through Sunday at noon. There are people all over the country that are bidding on these items, by the way.
And if you want to win, you probably have to go more than once. You have to go now, but then you're going to have to come back just before it ends on the 14th.
Right. You know, it's really cool. If you bid on something and somebody outbids you, like by $5 or something, you get a message on at your email.
Nice.
And it says, you've been outbid, so then you can go back and bid. I'm kind of doing that with a few items. I wanted to also talk about a few other food items that aren't necessarily restaurants. We have the Wild Alaskan Sockeye Salmon. We have Second Avenue Pizza gift certificates, two of those. We have Red Wheelbarrow Produce. That's from the farmer's market. We have two gift certificates for that. We have the famous Mike Meisner apple pies.
Oh, boy.
Those are right there. There's two of them. And we also have Sky's the Limit, catered in-house dinner for six. Now, that is something else.
That would be something else.
But
that
Susie,
would be a fun dinner.
My bicycle needs a tune-up for the spring. Is there anything for me?
There's actually three things for you, Phil. There's Greasy Fingers gift certificate, there's Bonner Bikes, and there's Syringa Cyclery.
Wow.
And what about my car, Susie? What if it needs help?
Steve's Import Auto, Perfection Tire.
That's right.
I've memorized these things. But I also... there's floral from, what is it?
Don't say that. Then there'll be people listening that'll expect I bid on that.
Because you've bid on it. Well, I know.
Let's
I know how that is. Petal Talk and Neiman's Floral. We have books from a book, a really cool history book of this area from the, what is that? The museum.
The museum, the Bonner County Historical Society.
That's right.
Yes.
And a membership with that and some guest passes.
Very nice.
We have this is a big one, a weekend at Schweitzer in a beautiful, beautiful condo with, I think it's 10 passes, ski passes.
And just think about it, folks. If you've got family that want to come to town and do a little skiing, they don't have to stay at your place. They can just be up there. So whether the family bids or you bid, it's a win-win.
And if you have family in town that you want to get out of town for the weekend.
There we go.
There we have it.
Okay.
Susie, when does it end?
It ends Sunday.
We don't have that much more time.
At noon Pacific time. So that the Eastern time people that are bidding don't have to stay up till midnight. That was a consideration for them. I also want to talk about some of the spa treatments we have from Headlines Haircuts. We have student massages at North Idaho Massage Academy. And then we have other massages, Sherry Daly, Wildflower Spa over at the Seasons. Also from... Okay, keep going.
Might be fun to bid on a student massage and a graduate massage person.
You could put together a whole unique package here.
Right.
No
kidding.
You
could. You could just like really take care of someone. Highland North Day Spa, two professional massages right there. We have some Bella Jezza items and services. I mean, the list goes on. It's pretty amazing, actually. It's really fun. We have seven ticket entertainments. We kind of already talked about that. But another big one, this is also kind of being bid on internationally or at least nationally, is a week, 7 days, I think it's 8 nights, at a Turks and Caicos.
Oh, nice.
Penthouse place. This and that's in the Caribbean.
An exotic island getaway. Oh, my goodness.
You can bid on that.
You I want that. To bid on Julie, that. Go not for sure it. If I can bid on that.
I'll bid that up.
That's a good one, though. My goodness. So we really run the gamut. And for local folks, there's even things as simple. So you can bid high or low on things. But we have things as simple as gift certificates to local stores. I know that North 40 has donated. So
that's right.
Little or big, get online and check it out. There's something for everyone.
There's evergreen wreaths that some folks have made. So there's items all around. But one of the things we want to do is really thank our donors, because without them, this wouldn't even be here online at 88 or at krfy.org or biddingforgood.com/krfy. This wouldn't happen. But then we need you to go and bid and go online right now and check it out.
It takes the whole community.
That's right. We need the donations and we need the bidders. And now it's the bidders' turn. So I hope you'll all go online. Susie, remind us one more time and then we'll finish for the morning.
Okay. It's krfy.org. That's our website. And it's on the right-hand side. There's a button that says bid here now, auction. Or you can go to biddingforgood.com/krfy. And as Jack and Ricky say, happy shopping. Good luck.
Good luck.
Well, happy shopping, everyone. And with that, we're going to take it out for this week. Thank you for joining us on the Tuesday morning show. And to finish out our show this morning, we've got Ray Charles with Hit the Road, Jack. It's another anniversary.
What a way to go.
That's right.
See you next Tuesday.
Very good.